KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Oh, I live in San Jose, near Campbell.
Bayview.
Coming up, Trump supporters rally in Berkeley.
There are so many people trying to destroy his presidency, and we just want to show our support.
Then what it means to live in a sanctuary city.
I am very afraid that there are people who will just remain quiet in order to remain under the radar.
And we'll hear from a leader in a growing interfaith movement that's pledging support for undocumented immigrants.
In our current society, we are saying migration is a crime. And some of us just don't believe that that's true.
The politics of undocumented immigration, coming up on Cross Currents. Stay with us. This morning, President Trump signed a new temporary travel ban imposed on nationals from a number of Muslim-majority countries. The first version of that ban, back in January, prompted anti-Trump protests around the country, including here in the Bay Area. Well, on Saturday, there were protests here again, this time supporting Trump. One demonstration was in Berkeley, and KALW's Carrie Spivak was there.
It was business as usual Saturday morning at the Civic Center Farmers Market. Romanesco broccoli is in season. Troubadour Mark Ray played music for tips. Around 1 o'clock, a crowd gathered a few steps away.
USA! USA! USA!
Pro-Trump supporters and anti-Trump protesters. As the crowd grew to hundreds, screaming confrontations broke into one-on-one fistfights. Somebody launched blue smoke bombs.
Take a knee!
Everybody down!
Take a knee! We are nonviolent! We do not start conflict! Take a knee! Let the police do their job!
While march organizer Rich Black tried to calm his group, about 40 police officers wearing riot helmets and carrying batons watched from the sidelines. Stacy Kaplan from Novato wore a small canister of pepper spray on a strap around her wrist.
I will defend myself if I have to, but to me, I want to stand for my country. I want to stand for the president. I want to stand for religious liberty. I want to stand for all of these things, and that's why I'm here.
Before Saturday, Eva Peters from Danville had never been to a political protest, but she felt compelled.
There are so many people trying to destroy his presidency and trying to make sure he doesn't get his policies through, and we just want to show our support.
No plans for future marches have been announced, but Peters says this will probably be the first of many marches for Trump that she will attend.
I don't think it's ending anytime soon.
In Berkeley, I'm Carrie Spivak for KALW News.
The Berkeley police said they arrested 10 people at that demonstration. Earlier this year, President Trump issued an executive order promising to halt funding for sanctuary cities. That's cities that limit cooperation with immigration agents. And mayors across the country vowed to remain sanctuary cities anyway.
This doesn't change the way we're going to police our city.
We want Oaklanders to know that their city government is committed to protecting them.
Amidst this backdrop of threat and resistance, Oakland resident Sharmila Kanagalingam watched closely, feeling confused and conflicted, wondering what exactly was at stake.
You know, being a Democrat and a liberal, I am questioning whether or not sanctuary cities are doing a public good, or has it just become a way for liberals and Democrats to be anti the government of the day.
Kanagalingam reached out to our crowdsourced collaborative reporting project, Hey Area, and asked us to go past the divide to find the meaning and history behind sanctuary cities. KALW's Holly J. McDeed has that story.
Sanctuary cities have been in the news a lot lately.
Our order also does the following: ends the policy of catch and release at the border, requires other countries to take back their criminals. They will take them back. Cracks down on sanctuary cities. Empowers ICE officers to target and remove those who pose a threat to public safety.
President Trump's January executive order came after a campaign promise to block funds for sanctuary cities. Losing all federal funding would mean a $1.2 billion loss for San Francisco, around 13% of the city's budget. So, city attorney Dennis Herrera sued the feds.
The federal government can put a gun to the heads of states and localities to force them to do their bidding.
Herrera, not unlike Trump, says the federal government has failed miserably at securing the borders for the last three decades. But Herrera says it's not San Francisco's job to fix that.
If the federal government wants to carry out its responsibility for immigration enforcement and deportation, great. But don't ask localities to do what you have ignored for all too long.
If you really want to understand the controversy of today, you might have to take a step inside an unlikely place, a church.
So this will be where I came as a newly arrived refugee.
Jose Artiga once lived here, inside the Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church in San Francisco's Castro District. He fled El Salvador in the early 80s after a death squad, a group of government-backed assassins, came looking for him.
So my sister came early in the morning, physically as I was leaving the house where I was staying, and told me, "This is what happened last night. You gotta go. There is no time for questions. There is no time for investigation. You gotta go."
There were many like Artiga. Nearly a fifth of El Salvador's population fled the country's violent civil war. But Artiga says the Reagan administration didn't want to admit that the Salvadoran government, an ally in the fight against communism, was also funding death squads.
"And I can tell you tonight, democracy is beginning to take root in El Salvador, which until a short time ago knew only dictatorship."
Artiga says the U.S. government wanted to keep the violence under wraps.
More and more refugees were coming from El Salvador to the U.S. And as people were applying for political asylum, after a few years, we realized that 98-99% of the political asylum applications were denied.
But that didn't stop the mass exodus. Nearly a fifth of El Salvador's population fled the country's violent civil war. So churches around the United States stepped up, declaring themselves public sanctuaries. Church leaders offered to feed, shelter, and provide attorneys for the thousands fleeing violence. But many immigrants were still afraid of deportation and the police.
The San Francisco police actually took part in several immigration raids during that era.
Bill Hing is an immigration professor at the University of San Francisco. He says immigrants were afraid to report crime.
The police were not trustworthy to the immigrant community. Even the lawful immigrant community thought that, why should we cooperate? We're afraid to report crimes that we are victims of or witnesses to.
Hing remembers when police helped immigration agents raid a Mission nightclub. 200 people were told they couldn't leave the club unless they proved they were legal U.S. residents.
And that was quite upsetting because it scared the heck out of immigrant communities, especially in the Mission District, where many Mexicans lived. And then there was beginning to be an influx of Guatemalans and El Salvadorans at that time.
In response to outrage, Hing helped the city draft its first binding sanctuary ordinance in 1989.
The original ordinance basically was a non-cooperation statement.
It said, no more using city resources to help federal immigration agents. Refusing to cooperate with federal authorities was immediately controversial. By 1992, San Francisco was at risk of losing federal funding unless they changed the policy. So city officials said they'd start cooperating with immigration agents for people with felonies. But even with that change, some people say sanctuary cities are still unconstitutional. Here is former U.S. Attorney Peter Nunez.
To decide we're going to opt out of some law that Congress has passed is just not, it's a non-starter. I mean, why didn't they just decide we're not going to follow the Internal Revenue Code anymore? Why should they decide they're going to follow any law? I mean, what makes immigration so different than any other law that they can decide, no thank you?
Nunez is a board member of the Center for Immigration Studies, a research group that supports tighter controls for immigration. He says undocumented immigrants suspected of any crimes in San Francisco should be reported to immigration agents. But besides that, he says, sanctuary city policies help encourage illegal immigration.
I mean, if you're in, country X and you're poor and you're looking for a better life, and you read in the paper that if I can make it to San Francisco and I'm going to be protected, not only am I not going to be arrested, I'm going to be protected, why would you not decide I'm going to San Francisco? I mean, this is the greatest inducement for additional future illegal immigration than you can imagine.
When Maria Hernandez moved to San Francisco from Mexico in the early 90s, she actually didn't know about the city's sanctuary policy. Here's Hernandez with Ana Herrera translating.
Antes de saber que existía Ciudad Santuario, ni siquiera sabía que tenía derechos.
Before I learned what a sanctuary city was or that San Francisco was a sanctuary city, I didn't even know I had any rights. So I didn't feel comfortable or safe at all reporting anything to the police. I'm actually a survivor of domestic violence, and I didn't feel safe reporting any of that before I knew that I had rights in the sanctuary city.
When she did learn she lived in a sanctuary city and what that meant, her perspective on herself and the world around her changed.
Ha sido como un respiro, porque ya venimos sufriendo de muchas situaciones.
It's been a breath of fresh air, a respite, because knowing that we have rights in the U.S., in the city, that we have access to services, it gives me a calmness, and it gives me a semblance of normalcy in my life.
Sanctuary cities help people like Hernandez feel welcome. But opponents argue earning trust shouldn't require protecting criminal suspects who may have also broken federal immigration law. By 2008, the sanctuary city policy came under attack. It captured national attention when Edwin Ramos allegedly shot and killed three people during a traffic dispute in the city's Excelsior neighborhood. Here's Fox News' Megyn Kelly.
A suspected MS-13 gang member here illegally from El Salvador. Ramos had been convicted of two violent crimes as a juvenile, but he was never referred to the feds for deportation because San Francisco is a sanctuary city.
Even though Ramos was undocumented and committed two felonies as a juvenile, he was never turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Danielle Bologna blamed the sanctuary policy for the death of her husband and two sons.
It was a senseless crime. And had they done something, this animal would not have taken my family.
In theory, under the revised sanctuary city policy, San Francisco should have turned Ramos over to ICE. But he committed felonies as a teen, and at the time, the city's policy only specifically addressed adults. The murders caused an uproar. Mayor Gavin Newsom instructed officials to turn over to ICE not just convicted minors, but also juveniles who were only suspects in felony crimes.
In the fall of 2008, we saw around 140 children get transferred for deportation as a result of this policy.
Francisco Ugarte, an immigration attorney with the San Francisco Public Defender's Office, says city employees went above and beyond Newsom's orders. Kids started to be turned over to ICE after minor crimes, like bringing BB guns to school or stealing change. And that, he says, had consequences.
Deportation of a person is an incredibly severe and harmful act to that child, because you could be sending that child to their deaths in their country. I mean, their parents may not be in the country where they came from, or they may be fleeing violence.
The immigrant community was outraged that so many young people were now facing deportation. In response, the city changed its policy again to say, basically, don't send minors to ICE unless they've been convicted of a felony. Over the years, the policy continued to evolve, allowing for greater protections for undocumented immigrants. Then, in 2015, another fatal tragedy. Again, here's Fox News' Megyn Kelly.
In
Kate was shot and killed while in her father's arms. Police say by this man, Francisco Sanchez, an illegal immigrant who had been deported 5 times from this country and had racked up a string of felonies.
Kate Steinle was killed on the Embarcadero after Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez was released by the Sheriff's Department. Lopez Sanchez did have a history of felonies, but none were violent. The tragedy caught Donald Trump's attention during his presidential run. Mayor Ed Lee blamed the sheriff for not calling ICE before Lopez Sanchez got out. The sheriff, in turn, said he was following the sanctuary ordinance. When Vicky Hennessy ran for sheriff that same year, she promised to cooperate more with ICE, and she won.
And I ran on having stricter enforcement of immigration laws. I did run on that, but once I got here and I started working with everybody in city government and I worked in, with people in the community, I realized that the problem in making it too strict would have been to cause that distrust of the community.
Hennessy says she compromised with the city's Board of Supervisors to bring the ordinance to where it is today. Now Hennessy only notifies ICE of an inmate's release if the person has committed certain felonies over the last 7 years and is facing another felony charge.
And I've been looking at every single one, and I've been having people take a look at their backgrounds, making sure that we're catching people who may fall into any of these categories, and we haven't found one yet.
But ICE isn't giving up on asking the Sheriff's Department for help. Hennessy says since Trump came into office, she's receiving even more requests from ICE and for lower-level crimes. Still, she says, San Francisco's sanctuary city laws preserve a level of confidence between the undocumented community and local police. But if ICE has an address, there's nothing the city or state can do to stop federal agents from showing up at someone's door.
Yes, we do.
Sanctuary city supporters and that's why, more than 3 decades after the sanctuary movement began, churches are still helping undocumented immigrants plan for the worst. Today, at this Presbyterian church in East Oakland, a group is using participatory bilingual theater to teach immigrants their constitutional rights. A woman in one scene demands ICE show her a warrant.
Do you have a warrant?
Yes, we do.
Put it under the door.
We're looking for Olga Salvatore.
Sanctuary City supporters and opponents both agree President Trump needs help from local law enforcement if he wants to meet his deportation goals. But in California, at least, that kind of help might get harder to come by. In the coming months, the state legislature will consider restricting local police from communication with immigration agents. Many say that move would turn California into a sanctuary state. In San Francisco, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
This story is part of Hey Area, KALW's collaborative reporting project. Got a question for Hey Area? Find all the details on our website, kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Today, there's a revival underway of the original refugee sanctuary movement, where churches are the sanctuary spaces. More than 800 congregations have signed on to offer refuge to undocumented immigrants who face deportation orders. Reverend Deborah Lee is program director of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, which advocates on behalf of immigrants. For KALW's The Spiritual Edge, Judy Silber sat down with Reverend Lee to understand more.
This is something I've been really curious about, is why there are certain faith communities that feel so compelled to be involved in the sanctuary movement, to be involved in helping immigrants. Like, where does that fit in with different faith doctrines?
Yeah. Wow, it's such an elemental part of all faith traditions, whether it's Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Sikhism, Hinduism. We cannot avoid where in our scripture it talks about how we are to treat the newcomer, the stranger, the migrant. Why? Because historically and still today, anyone who is migratory is incredibly vulnerable. So one thing that we do to get the word out, so to speak, is we actually have a monthly interfaith vigil.
We stand here in front of one of the 250 immigration detention centers across this country.
At the closest detention center here in the Bay Area Detention Center, which is called the West County Detention Facility in Richmond. And we have an immigration theme prayer service.
We pray for all their families, because often the breadwinner is taken away, a mother or a father, putting children and families in economic jeopardy and under the threat of homelessness. We pray and offer our moral, spiritual, and concrete support to the families whose loved ones are here.
But you know, we use the current immigration context as a way to reflect on our faith and what does it mean for us today. Like when the children came in 2014 and there was a flood of people at that detention center and they were being released into the lobby with nowhere to go.
And who are they? Where are they coming from?
They come from all over and it can change day to day. They're not necessarily local. Some of them will be local people, but they're also people that could come through the border and then are detained. And then the Richmond facility is one of 250 detention centers. So they're just kind of moved around.
All over the country.
All over the country.
Can you talk about the involvement of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity around issues of immigration, say over the last 5 years?
One is we've actually done three delegations to Central America to better understand the root causes of what's been happening so critically in these last few years that have caused this major influx of Central American migrants.
And who goes on those delegations?
Well, it's been mostly faith leaders. And we just got back in December, actually, from Honduras and are publishing our report. And it's really been critical for us because what's happened is that we actually feel our country has been very misguided, for example, by putting more money in those three countries for security. For militarization. It's not solving anything. In fact, it's exacerbating it. The news we were getting about the root causes or why people were coming was very skimpy. You know, it was very like poverty and gangs, you know, and then we're trying to get a little bit deeper at there are some serious conditions, including in Honduras, the 2009 coup, which has basically led to the wholesale privatization.
And where unemployment is, it's over 50%,
I believe.
Oh my
gosh, right? Yes, it's extremely high. In the community that we visited, which was a former plantation center for Chiquita bananas, which we've used Honduras to produce our bananas for a century, there's 80% unemployment.
So what are the religious roots of the sanctuary movement?
Well, it's actually really interesting because, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it goes back to the Book of Numbers, where there is an establishment of cities of refuge. And there's an understanding that there needs to be a place of respite when there are acts of violence happening to stop the blood feud from going back and forth. So those are some of the like spiritual roots of it. And I think it continued like through the Roman Empire in the fourth century, churches were seen as sanctuary, where those who are wrongly accused or those who are guilty of unjust laws. So it's really interesting to think about that in light of today's immigration system. Those who are wrongly accused are those guilty of unjust laws, because in our current society, we are saying migration is a crime. And some of us just don't believe that that's true. And then, of course, in the 80s, when the Central American refugees, they adopted this term sanctuary because at that time, U.S. law was not considering them refugees. And so they were going to be, a million of them were going to be deported back to certain death. And
there was no way to apply for asylum.
There was like a 99.9% rejection rate.
So what, I mean, is there going to be a new sanctuary movement?
And there is.
If so, what does it look like?
Yeah. Well, there is a new sanctuary movement. And we have been working in the last few years to cultivate more sanctuary congregations here in the Bay Area that has a physical space for somebody who may need physical sanctuary as a deportation defense strategy, as an open door of last resort to be able to offer to people with a final order of deportation. It's been challenging because we don't actually know what it's all going to look like. We don't know the demand in the months ahead. The kind of sanctuary that we have been doing under the Obama administration has been a much more orderly kind of sanctuary, a very strategic sanctuary. We're working with the person's attorney, announcing to ICE publicly that this person has entered into sanctuary and using the moral weight and the community support and media support to push for a humanitarian resolution to a case.
So when you go around to congregations, are you sort of laying out this scenario of you may be needed in a very fundamental way, and this is an act of civil disobedience, and be prepared for that?
Yes,
I'm just wondering,
yes.
how do you talk about that?
Well, part of the expansion of the notion of sanctuary is that we talk about this as a network. So I tell them every congregation doesn't have to play that role of housing. But it is the more challenging because that is where the law is subject to interpretation. And under the new executive order, the issues of how people who might be construed as harboring could be punished, which is a very broad language. There are, of course, other laws about harboring. And the way that the sanctuary movement has interpreted that law is that harboring means concealing. And actually what we're doing is actually public sanctuary. So we're coming out to the public because we're actually counting on public support. Through that, we feel can help to garner protection because people are getting deported invisibly, by the hundreds every day, and we don't see it. And so we just feel like not one should go by without people knowing and with us consciously as a country realizing what we're doing and the true cost of what we're doing.
That's Reverend Deborah Lee of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity speaking with KALW's Judy Silber. To listen to more interviews and stories from KALW's Spiritual Edge Project, go to KALW.org, click on Cross Currents, and then Spiritual Edge. And that's all for Cross Currents. Today's production team includes Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Kavalroop Singh. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.